Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today, we talk with a couple of authors who encourage us to be in control of our lives. In 1971, the Boston Women's Health Collective published the very first edition of a groundbreaking book, Our Bodies, Ourselves. First selling a quarter of a million copies, largely by word of mouth, in 1973, Simon & Schuster republished it commercially, and the rest is history, sort of. This book put women's health in a political and social context where it had never been before, talking frankly about sexuality, abortion, and childbirth. But we must wonder if the empowerment that women have worked so hard for is in actuality still nascent. In 1970, 5% of all births in the United States were by cesarean section. However, if you were born in the 1970s or the 80s or the 90s, the chance of you having a C-section giving birth to your own child has risen to 32% as of 2015. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Thais Nye Derich, whose memoir is Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After Cesarean. This memoir was one of the best I've read in a while, and though the title suggests something clinical, I found this book a compelling page-turner that spoke to many social, cultural, and medical issues that affect us all. Later in the broadcast, we'll visit with Kathy Langlois, whose book is Enlighten Up, Practical Wisdom and Spiritual Guidance for an Imperfect World. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Thais Nye Derich is a writer whose work has appeared in Salon, Literary Mama, Forge Journal, SFGate, and the San Francisco Examiner, to name a few. It was the birth of her first child by cesarean that sent Thais on a path of self-examination and learning to discover that she, like many other women, was a victim of the medical establishment and was denied the human right of birthing her own child. Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After Cesarean, is not just a book about childbirth, but about control over our own lives and bodies, and simply about being human. Here is our conversation. Thais Nye Derich, welcome to Sonoma County to talk about your beautiful book, Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After a Cesarean. The title of your book doesn't quite say it all. It says a lot, but it doesn't really say it all. This is a memoir that is about your path and your experience, but it really contains a lot more and is actually pretty much of a page-turner, too. So how did you not only come to write the book, but to structure it the way you did?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'm so happy to hear it's a page-turner. I hear that from pretty much everybody. That is exactly what I wanted when I wrote the book, and that's why I structured it the way I did. I've read a lot of birth stories, and they're wonderful, and that's how I learned a lot about how birth can be. But sometimes they're hard to read, and I had to tell my birth story, but I wanted to make sure it was gripping and kept people's interest. And so that's why I decided to do the weave. I wrote the story chronologically, and then I actually had to cut a lot to do the weave, which was a good exercise.
And tell us what the weave is.
So I'm telling two different birth stories, so two children, and one chapter is the story of the first child, and the next chapter is the second child, and it's the story of their births and also my growth and life during those two time periods.
You start the book off talking about a little bit about your own story and your birth mother.
I start with that so people get to know me a little bit and where I'm starting from. And through the whole experience, my birth mother abandoned me when I was around four. I was had a great life. We were raised by my stepmother and father and, you know, very happy childhood. So I didn't really think anything of losing my mother until I became a mother myself and realized that the trauma of that time period actually had some effect on my birth and not being able to open up because I was still so guarded from not healing from that time period.
So for our listeners and our readers, you were pregnant and went to the hospital to deliver your baby and had a prolonged labor and were essentially treated as a pregnancy as a medical issue rather than a human issue, really. And it wasn't convenient. It sounds like a lot of this, it just wasn't convenient for your doctor either to maybe wait it out with you. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But then this really affected you after the birth of your baby, too, and sent you on a trajectory of amazing growth and development that led to a natural birth after a cesarean of your second child.
Yeah, it's interesting how sometimes your worst, most traumatic experiences can lead to better choices and a more aware life afterwards. So that's exactly what happened. I did everything I was supposed to do. Prenatal care, birth class, lived in San Francisco, and went in thinking I was going to get the best care I could possibly get. And of course, you know, I'm going to have my baby naturally because I'm like a human and that's what we do. And I'm athletic and healthy and there's no reason why this shouldn't happen. And what I didn't know was I was stepping into a major healthcare problem in the United States where cesareans have gone up 500%. Women are being offered and advised to have cesareans when it's not really an emergency. Doctors are getting paid $2,500 per birth, no matter how long they spend with you. So cesareans are done in 20 minutes. Births can take days. So there's a lot of different layers of what's going on in our hospitals right now. And if you're not aware of that, it's really easy to fall into the cascade of interventions that lead to something that you didn't want.
I wonder why this is, if it's partly the medical establishment and the business of it all, and partly maybe culturally, spiritually, even we have become a little bit separated from the fact that we are capable of bearing children. We watch giraffes on YouTube and wait for them, you know, to give birth to a child and watch that process, but somehow don't think there's a disconnect that we do that too. And I think there are some women who probably think, I don't want to go through that kind of pain. I think I'll just schedule it for next Tuesday or something like that.
Yeah, no, you know, it's okay not to want pain, but you're not pain-free with a cesarean. And I think that's where the education that we're getting from our medical providers isn't always accurate and could be, you know, somewhat biased. It could be unconscious bias, but we're being advised to do things that aren't necessarily in our best interests. And I've done a lot of research on this and who's making the decisions that pushing for 3 hours is enough. And after that, even if mom and baby are fine, it's time for a cesarean. There is an organization called the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and they make recommendations for obstetricians to follow in the hospitals. In the hospitals, it's a highly regarded, and even though it's a membership-based organization, their recommendations are very impactful. So it's been around for a while. It's had 47 presidents. All have been white males. Four have been women. And the only doctor of color is elected next year. So, you know, we're starting from a place from the very top. There's hardly any women making decisions for women. And so we can fight in the trenches, but until we fix who's making decisions for us, and are those decisions one view, or are they representing all the different women out there, women, Native Americans, brown, black, white, European, whatever. There's not one way to give birth. And we're funneling everybody through a one-way medical way. And it's all founded in a medical model that women are actually, since the 1970s, just stepping into kind of a male-dominated medical field. So in the 1970s, 9% of medical school graduates were women. At the end of the 70s, it was more like 25%. But that's not that long ago. That's when I was born. So in my generation, yeah, we have a lot of women in medicine right now, but they're stepping into a man's world. And so the conflict there is huge when you get into giving birth, because that's something women know how to do that and are the only ones that are going to be doing that. So why don't we have more women at the top making these recommendations?
And in your experience, in your second birth, you worked with a midwife and a doula and a support kind of structure of women around you. But yet many women might not even think about that kind of access when their main point of contact is through their doctor or their health plan. Though your first doctor who delivered your child was a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where you're being trained. You know, it's not like she wanted to do anything mean to me. It's just, there's some disconnect with the emotional side of giving birth and the process side.
In fact, she at one time, and I'm paraphrasing, said something like, "We've got to get this baby out of here."
Yeah, it's time. It's time to get this baby out. You're fine. Your baby's fine. It's just time. Yeah, yeah. And she actually she didn't have kids herself, so she hadn't actually experienced birth before. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I doubt, because it's a huge, you know, 1 out of 3 women are having cesareans. So it's not just my little story. It's a huge epidemic.
That's a strong word.
It is. I mean, it's 44% of hospitals are banning vaginal births after cesarean. So if you have a cesarean, you could be forced into having surgery. Cesareans are the number one most performed surgery on human beings. And we're not saving any lives. It would be one thing if the United States had the lowest infant mortality rate and a maternal death rate, but we don't. We're one of the worst.
I was surprised by that. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. You just have the CDC ranking, Center for Disease Control ranking, and births are tracked in hospitals, and it's safer to give birth in Cuba than it is in the United States.
That is a shocking statistic, that women still die.
Yes, women still die, and there's a lot of bias and racism as well, because if you take a white woman, and you put her same, like her weight, and I don't know if she's had a previous child or whatever, and you put that up against the exact same woman, but she's black, the black woman is 3 times more likely to die than the white woman. And I don't know why. I'm not, you know, I'm a writer and a mom, and I'm just telling my story and I'm telling what I've learned along the way. But this is not okay. Like, something is wrong here. And what happens is women don't know about it until it's too late. So for me, I just, because I don't, when you're young, you're not hanging around traumatized mothers who've had, and maybe you don't talk about it. So the hurt just keeps coming over and over again, because there's nothing, nobody's stopping the wheel, because women are, and mothers are, in such a vulnerable position. Because, so I knew I was traumatized. I, you know, I had to quit my job. It was really tough for me, but I had a newborn, so I wasn't gonna, I didn't have time to go march the streets and pound on the hospital door and say, what's going on? Now I have time, a little more time. My kids are a little older, so I am joining, and I wrote this book, and I am getting to know who else is out there fighting for women's rights and childbirth and trying to make change.
And lest our readers and listeners think this is a statistical book, or it really is a personal story, and as you alluded to earlier, and in the afterword of your book, it talks about whether we suffer the trauma of it during childbirth or in life, we all face adversity. And I think that your book speaks to that, to acknowledging the hurt and pain and loss in your life and moving through it, which is also sometimes difficult. And in your case, it was moving from this experience, not only of the loss of your mother when you were four, but then this kind of assault, a surgical assault on you during your first childbirth. Mm-hmm. And the way you describe it in the book, I don't think that I'd ever read something that really put me on the gurney so much and actually felt your confusion as to what the heck is going on. And talk a little bit about that experience of going from thinking you were about to give birth to kind of being pushed, and your husband being separated from you and being pushed into a surgical suite.
Yeah. So I had to do hypnosis to figure out why I was crying so much after this birth. And I did all sorts of, therapy and all sorts of different things, but it was the hypnosis that walked me through the whole thing again and allowed me to see that there's like three points that led to PTSD. And one of the points is, like you said, my time's up, 3 hours is up. And I guess now they've changed the rule to 4 hours. So it's totally arbitrary. Like, when I give birth, it's three and now it's four. So it could be five next year. So my time was up and they're prepping me for the cesarean. And this is not fun. This is shaving your pubic hair. You have a shower cap on. You're getting IVs and all sorts of stuff. You have, all of a sudden, the room is swarmed with people. You have gurney men who are moving you from one bed to the other.
While you're in labor.
You know, I was pushing. So I was 10 and pushing. And there was the OR was open. So she really wanted to get there fast, because then someone else would take it. And she told me this. And so we needed to hurry. And so I hadn't really had time to digest the transition from the natural birth to the cesarean. So I was crying. I remember asking my husband, did I fail you? Just really sad. Even now I'm still upset about it. And so we're in the hallway, and there's a moment when we're about to enter the OR, and they ask my husband to stay behind. And that was horrible.
I think your emotion that you're feeling right now comes through very strongly in the book, too. So for readers, I felt your fear and I would call it fear and confusion about what is happening. And just as you said that you said to your husband, am I letting you down, or have I let you down? And we'll talk about his whole reaction to this in a minute. But it seems like that's something you were left with after the experience. And you had a cesarean birth to a beautiful, healthy boy, and you eventually all went home together. There was not a lot of complications after that. But the lingering emotion with you of maybe having failed on some level, whether that be yourself or your son, mm-hmm. Was something then that you had to deal with right up through to the birth of your second son.
Yeah, I had to have my second son naturally. I couldn't even think of having another cesarean. And that did heal me, that natural birth, the second time. So I was so, so grateful I was able to do that. I don't think I'd be here today.
But, you know, we all have heard stories, or many of us have. I know my mother would talk to me about my own birth, and it seems like labors used to be allowed to go on for 24 hours or, you know, for a long time. And it could be that there was just a different ethos about the whole thing then. And
well, the 70s was the women's movement. So before the 70s, it was the twilight sleep, where they would inject women with drugs that they would feel all the pain of labor but not remember it. That, you know, before the 70s, it was men can't come in the room. Then there was the women's movement, and there was an opportunity for change during that decade. And we've fallen back from that. The 70s, 51% of women had natural birth after cesarean. Now it's 8%. So there's a huge difference. We have lost that little window of women's empowerment in birth that we had in the 70s.
And that's what women do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's what women do, is give birth.
Mm-hmm.
And that you discovered that you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like at one point in the book, you say, I'm going to have another kid if this doesn't work out the way,
yeah.
You know, the way you wanted it to. But so you did go on to have a natural birth at home, and everybody was kind of telling you were nuts to even think about doing this.
Yeah. You know, I didn't know about home birth until I realized I wasn't going to get my natural birth in the hospital. I was just looking for how I was going to do this, you know, and then that's how I discovered home birth. And even, you know, some midwives didn't want to take me on as a client even at home birth because of the perceived risk of having a vaginal birth after a cesarean at home, which scientifically is, I did a ton of research to make sure I was going to be safe. And it's perfectly, I mean, everybody needs to do their own research. But for me, I was feeling like I was more safe at home than I would be in the hospital for my situation and my psychological needs.
And you did surround yourself by an experienced midwife.
Yeah. So that was my main thing, was like, okay, I know all I need is someone that can see the signs of uterine rupture and take me to the hospital if anything goes out of the normal spectrum. Like, I don't want to kill myself here. I just want to have my baby how my body is made to have a baby. And I knew I could do it if I had people that believed in me and weren't ready to give me a cesarean at the slightest sign of something.
Delay
or anything, you know. And also, you go into the hospital and it's a foreign place. It's uncomfortable. If you're not, it's hard to open up if you're nervous about people not looking out for your best interests. And I just couldn't find that trust in a hospital setting.
In the book, you talk about when a deer is giving birth, she may kind of suck it back in, and if she feels threatened. And it seemed like part of the work, the personal work you were doing, is maybe correlating the trajectory of your giving birth, especially the first time, but maybe also the second time, of not opening up, as you say, maybe because of your own birth or early life trauma, or
I mean, I definitely feel like dealing with any past trauma is a good idea before you give birth, if you know to do that. And so this is all hindsight, right? I know way more now than I did then. And that's I am like the poster child of why this keeps happening, right? Because you just don't think that you need to heal from your mother abandoning you in order to have a successful birth. Like, I just had never thought about that. I definitely think that some of that had something to do with it, but I was so close to having that baby. Like, I think if they had just given me another hour, I could have done it.
Yeah, yeah. And it happened the way it did.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel lucky in a way that, you know, sometimes we have to experience trauma to see injustices in the world. And now I see the problem, and it's huge.
It sounds like a lot of it is education, the medical community, and perhaps our changing identity or identification with ourselves as women.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with just trusting women to know what's right for themselves, just listening to them. So, you know, my vision for the future would be more options. So instead of telling women what they can and can't do by laws or arresting their midwife or arresting them because they're not coming in for a cesarean. Instead of doing that, how about we set up our medical system to support whatever the woman chooses to do? And, you know, and that could be something I don't even know right now, because people have different ideas of how they want to give birth to their child. And let's just support them and trust them that they know what's best for their body.
I'm talking with Thais Nai Darich, and her book is Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After a Cesarean. It's a memoir of a time in your life, and it's told in a way that weaves different storylines together. And at one point, you decide to tell your young son, your firstborn son, that he was born from a cesarean section. That's maybe not how you put it, but you seemed to feel that was a very important thing that you needed to communicate with him. And I wondered about that, and I wonder about it now, and I wonder what the ramifications of that have been now that he's older.
Yeah. So my son and I have an awesome relationship. He's 11 now. So telling him that he was born, I showed him the scar in the bathroom, and even now he's seen me go around talking, and I ask him, you know, how does that feel for me to be up there, like, talking about your birth like this? Because it was a traumatizing time for me, even though I love you and you're fine and it has nothing to do with you traumatizing me. And he says, Mom, you are so powerful and strong.
There you have it.
Yeah. So yeah. If I have done nothing else, that's good enough for me.
Yes. And your other son, Miko, does he also have an awareness of his birth and also the different experience you had?
Yeah. So he's still young, and he's also a different child in the way he approaches life. So the way I know how he is interpreting how he was born is he is a fiery rocket. I mean, he is strong and strong-headed and just, he is going to do amazing things. But it's not the same relationship I have with my other son. I think mostly because they're just different. Two different personalities. Yeah.
And during this all, and as you express it in the book, your husband was intimately involved in both births. Yet at a certain point, it seemed like you had a realization that this was your task, your life mission to give birth the way you wanted to give birth. Mm-hmm. And he may not even have understood some of your pain or lingering trauma from the experience. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk a little bit about that? And we should say you're happily married and it all worked out. But yeah. I think this is probably not uncommon for couple, even the closest of couples, to experience something around pregnancy and postpartum especially.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably happens. I mean, I'm sure people who have suffered from cancer or other things may have felt the same. When something happens to your body, there's only so much other people can do for you. And you are, I was one with him up until this point when I realized, wow, there's no way he can understand this. You know, I need to figure this out on my own and stop like asking too much of him. And I just hunkered down and got the job done. And it made me more of my own person. It was a good personal growth period for me, gaining that strength as an individual while being happily married.
And it sounds like you had a lot of help from a lot of other people, a lot of other women who wanted to hear your story and listen to you and respected your point of view. And in the book, there's a description of you meeting with a potential backup midwife who, I'm not going to remember her name right now, but she had had many children herself. She was German.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And that she kind of just said, you got to get down and do it.
Yeah. So she mirrored kind of what I had figured out on my own. And I loved that afternoon I spent with her. She has so much wisdom and she was right. Like, she's like, you know what? You might end up back in the hospital. Your beautifully planned home birth with your birth tub and your doula and your midwife and your candles, like, that might not happen. And you're still going to have this baby. So you need to just get the job done and do what you need to do and forget about what's happening all around you. And I think about that and I'm like, wow, if I had learned this from my hospital birth, I probably could have had my baby in the hospital. But I was so dependent on everybody around me in that hospital birth to tell me what I should be doing that the power of that birth wasn't mine. And the power of the second birth was mine.
And has led to bigger power in your life.
Yeah. I would hope so. I feel like I'm still growing, but yeah, I feel good. I feel happy, you know.
For our listeners and readers, this book, Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After a Cesarean, it's under 200 pages, but it is a good story. And I think it speaks to not just women and not just women who are experiencing or have experienced pregnancy or cesarean. I think it has wider appeal to us as sentient beings who have the ability to control our lives and our destinies. And we sometimes have that taken out of our reality by the media, by the medical establishment, and by our own lack of knowledge.
I definitely wrote this to help women that are wanting to have a natural birth after a cesarean. But what the feedback I'm getting is, you don't have to even be anywhere near wanting to have a baby right now to read this. There was a 70-year-old at my book talk who told her birth story and really was so touched by the book. I've had men read it that are very touched by it. So, yeah, I think in the end, it's a memoir. And if you like to read memoirs, then...
And it's a page-turning memoir. So Thais, thanks for coming up and
that was
and
my
joining
conversation
us today
with Thais Nye Darich.
This
her
great
name
book.
Is spelled
thanks for coming.
T-H-I-S-D-A-R-C-H. Thanks for having me.
Darich, and her website is thaisdarich.com. You can visit her there. And her book is Second Chance: A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After Cesarean. Let's take a break with something from Buffy St. Marie and her album, Power in the Blood.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your known home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful if you got the sense to take care of your source of perfection. Mother Nature, she's the daughter of God and the source of all protection. Look right now and you will see she's only here by the skin of her teeth as it is. So take heart and take care.
That was Buffy St. Marie with Carry It On from her album Power in the Blood. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Kathy Langlois is the director of the Spirit Horse Center in Northern California and has written Enlighten Up, Practical Wisdom and Spiritual Guidance for an Imperfect World. I found her openness and straightforwardness of spiritual identity refreshing. Here is our conversation.
Kathy Langlois, welcome to talk to us today about your book, Enlighten Up, Practical Wisdom and Spiritual Guidance for an Imperfect World.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I think most people know when you say lighten up to somebody that it means that person might be a little uptight, a little taking things too seriously. Mm-hmm. But your book is called Enlighten Up. So yeah. What's the difference?
Well, it's kind of about waking up to who you really are. I mean, in a lot of ways, I wrote this book from teaching many, many people how to meditate or become more conscious of their feelings, become more conscious of what they want in the world. And these are little excerpts from classes, almost a distillation of things that I've taught people about how to become lighter as a spirit, how to become more bright. You know, when our spirit's present in our bodies, we shine. You know, there's a light that's present, and people notice you, and you're on your path more. So enlighten up is really obviously a play on words with some humor in it to get people to kind of take a look in themselves and bring their energy up, bring their spirit up to what they really want to do.
Well, throughout the book, you're really challenging the readers to do that. And several times in the book, you talk about checking in with yourself. Mm-hmm. And how does one do that? Or how does one know if they're doing that? Or you talk about listening to your inner voice.
Well, on the simplest level, it really has to do with taking enough time to just really sit in one spot, breathe, and even ask yourself a question. Just a lot of times people don't even ask themselves questions anymore about how am I really feeling? What do I really want? Am I happy here? Is this what I want to be doing? Do I like this person? It's a simple level, you know, other than taking many courses on spiritual work or meditation, of just taking a moment to quiet yourself down, separate from everything, separate from distractions preferably, and breathe, take a couple nice deep breaths, and just ask yourself a question. And that's kind of why in the course of the book, I put a lot of questions in there. So at some point, you may just ignore most of them, but one of those questions is going to make you go, huh, I don't really know if this is my emotion or not that I'm feeling, or why am I feeling frustrated or in resistance? And it's really geared, that book was geared toward questions, getting you to ask yourself questions. And my premise also is that you have your own answers. I mean, I don't have the answers for people. I can guide them or poke them a little bit to look for their own answers. But the whole point of that book was short, succinct pieces of information, and then some questions that you can maybe consider to help you find more information for yourself about who you are or what you want or where you are on your path. It's really questions are really valuable. It's an important thing.
How do you envision people using the book? Because it is written with short, pithy mm-hmm. little chapters, often having pointed questions at the end of it. And it's not the sort of book that one picks up and reads cover to cover necessarily.
I know I've had some people say to me that they've read it through 5 times already. And I said, how did you do that? Because it really was designed to kind of be picked up and just opened up to wherever it falls. And that's probably what you need to hear that day. And you may or may not do the questions at the end of the chapter, or you may just read it and go, oh my God, that's exactly what I needed to hear, and then go on with your day. And I want to preface this with saying that I originally designed this with a deck of cards. I made a deck of cards some years ago that were kind of like flash meditation cards. You could pull a card every day for the theme of the day or meditate on that theme. And the titles of the chapters of the book are actually from the cards. And I wrote the book because a lot of people said, man, those are great. They really stimulate me. But could you talk a little bit more about how you came to that? What is that thought? Where did that come from for you? So I just kind of on a whim just started sitting down and writing a few chapters going, well, when I was thinking about this, this is what was happening with me. And wrote them down. And then I started finding, well, gosh, if I just keep going with that, there's a lot of information in what experience I went through that brought me to that phrase. And then consequently, I started looking at, well, what can they do once they realize that this is happening to them? You know, here's some things you could try that I think would help shake you loose or whatever. And that's kind of how it was born. And so it's really designed to, my husband calls it a spiritual bathroom book, where you just pick it up at any time randomly and read something and then move on with your day. And that's kind of the purpose of it. So,
and in fact, there might be one or two chapters where the chapter title is almost as long as the chapter itself. Well, why don't we do that as an exercise and just open the book and maybe have you read something from it that might stimulate our readers. And I've just opened following Kathy's advice. I just opened the book to a chapter called Enlightenment Can Happen, Reaching for Frozen Peas at the Supermarket. Kathy, you want to read a little bit of this?
Sure. It's actually one of my favorite ones. And a phrase I used to say a lot when I was teaching that people always thought, oh, yeah, really, right. You laugh, but I've had some version of that happen to me many times. I do some of my best work in grocery stores. Well, maybe I haven't found total enlightenment, but I have come across answers to problems I'm having. Have you ever used a laser-like focus, concentrating with all your might as you search for the answer to a problem? The harder you try, the more stuck you get. Finally, you throw your hands up in the air in frustration. You go, forget it. I'm going to the movies. And there, munching on popcorn in the dark, some image or story leads you to your answer. You found the answer by letting it go. When you struggle to be any place other than where you are, it's avoidance, and it's a good bet those wheels you're spinning will stay stuck where they are. Acceptance brings you into the present moment, so action is again possible. Since spiritual growth is not a linear problem-solving journey, willing myself to consciousness has never seemed to help. I haven't been able to think my way to spiritual ascension yet. So if you meditate, trying to force a deeply spiritual experience or some particular result, you're going to feel like you've failed. You can't set up goals for enlightenment like you're training for a marathon. No matter how many affirmations and chants you recite, you can't force it. This is what frustrates many beginning meditators, as the laws of mind and body don't necessarily apply to spiritual enlightenment. Now, anything can be a catalyst, and I'm all for finding pearls of wisdom wherever you can. It all works and it all doesn't. Depends on where your consciousness is at the moment. But sometimes you just have to let it be and quit trying to get somewhere or find the answer. Many years ago, I was perusing the metaphysical section of a bookstore, desperately seeking the secret of the universe from some master or another to bail me out. As I pulled out a book, I heard a clatter as something fell to the floor. I reached down and picked it up. I'd found a key. I started giggling, and when the shop owner asked if she could help me, I grandiosely said, oh, no, I'm good. I did, after all, find the key. I was in dire need of humor. I mistakenly assumed that the more profound and pious my spiritual path, the further I'd get. To lighten up was the truth I stumbled on that day, though the store owner didn't seem to find it very amusing. Enlightenment is not another grade, degree, or achievement to be acquired. It can sneak up on you in those quiet moments during the most mundane of experiences, even buying frozen peas. Effortless being and appreciating right where we are in the moment is the quiet truth of enlightenment.
Thank you. That is an example of your voice in the book, too. There's a degree of humor and really trying to push through any specific language, specific spiritual kind of context, because it seems like a big part of what you're trying to say is that paying attention is very important, mm-hmm. and paying attention to yourself rather than maybe looking outside for something to be imposed upon you. And it seems like that's part of the message you're putting out there.
It really is. Though I do want to say that I also do emphasize to pay attention that spirit will give you answers from all the things around you, that you never know when, if you're asking for help internally, if you're looking for truth, pay attention. Like you said, it's about paying attention, because you never know when something's going to visit you with the answer that might just pop up. Just, I want to mention, I'm currently writing a second book, and I just finished writing one yesterday that was titled, You Never Know When You're Having Breakfast with the Buddha. Because you really have to pay attention to the least of us and what comes out of the what you consider sometimes the least situation or person can often be the most profound truth you need to pay attention to that day. So there is a lot in the book about, yes, of course, go within and then ask your questions and then see where the answers come from, because they will. They'll always come.
You also talk about relationships. It seems like sometimes we have to protect ourselves from relationships that may be harmful, manipulative, or undermining of our own selves and our own journeys.
I think it's kind of why I added the practical wisdom part to the book. As a spiritual person and spiritual teacher, I'm also aware of all sides of human nature. And this means that part of our growth is sometimes to experience what can be destructive or damaging relationships or situations that you need to learn from. It means don't deny them or don't think that everything is going to be perfect in your world or in your relationships, but do pay attention to caring for yourself enough or honoring yourself enough, I think, that you're going to protect and heal and move away from things that are destructive to your soul. And it's a reality. And, you know, I came to some of that, too, with I talk to a lot of people. I love to talk to waiters and waitresses and people on the street. And people talk to me everywhere, I guess. It's kind of a thing. And I found that there was a little bit of a lack of practical wisdom in some of the spiritual books out there of just day-to-day reality. There gets to be a little bit more emphasis on everything needing to be positive. And I don't know if I think of it as positive or negative, but just accepting that there's dark and light in the world and in all of us. And you need to pay attention to that. And so I wanted to answer some of the questions and things I got from people I just talked to at random about situations that they couldn't find clarity about or they needed a little help with. Like, gee, they got betrayed by a friend or something happened here. What do I do with that? What's wrong with me? Why did that happen? Well, there's nothing wrong with you. This stuff happens. And here's how you can deal with it. And so it's kind of a practical level of how to get by in life, too.
And insecurity and lack of confidence is something that many people are afflicted with. Yet, just as you said, well, there's nothing wrong with you. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes we have that kind of insecurity that prevents us from really even sometimes just doing what we want to do on a daily basis. And how do you approach that or how do you encourage others?
Well, I think one of the things that is important to understand is that it's okay to be insecure. It's okay that we all have those feelings that you doubt yourself. You might not have enough information about something, so you're not sure what to do. I mean, that's really a normal human experience, is to be unsure. I think sometimes we get this picture we're supposed to have all the answers all the time and know what we're doing, and we don't. And maybe it starts with just embracing the fact that we're all uncertain and insecure at various times. It's getting stuck in it and thinking that's all you are. Or the other part of that is taking responsibility for everything that's happening in your life and around you that you can't control, that starts to make people feel insecure and unsure. You have to let go. And you have to recognize that sometimes you're dealing with somebody else's stuff, that it isn't really your issue. They're having a problem, or they're insecure, or they're being controlling because they're in fear, and it isn't your problem. You always have to just go back to yourself and go, well, it comes back to kind of a basic level of also loving yourself no matter what position you're in. Maybe you are insecure, maybe you don't know what you're doing, maybe you're stuck, but you still get to love yourself. This is what we all experience. And I think that's kind of part of that thing that I'm really wanting to put out there too, is that you are okay. Just because you're in having this emotion or that emotion, we've all got those. We all do this. And I think people get they feel alone. And I think they get isolated and they start to think they're the only one. I can't tell you how many times I've been teaching a class and I've started to describe a situation, going, has anybody felt like this? And everybody's got their eyes closed because they're meditating. They're all shaking their heads, yes. And I go, you can't see it, but everybody in the room is shaking their head, yes, they've had this experience. And it's validating for them because they think they're the only one. And I'll even say, you thought you were the only one, didn't you? And they go, yep. And so that's kind of part of this. There's an inclusiveness that I'm trying to put in this too, where I made the writings all pretty palatable to any walk of life and any level of spiritual development. I've had beginners read it, and I've had people who are down the road who've done all kinds of spiritual things. And I'm trying to take these basic universal truths about who we are in the world and what we're all experiencing and make it so everybody can go, oh, I'm not alone. Oh, other people are doing this. So that's kind of my approach to it.
And I'm talking with Kathy Langlois, and the book is Enlighten Up, Practical Wisdom and Spiritual Guidance for an Imperfect World. And you also do encourage people to, I don't know if you use the exact term take risks, but to follow impulses that might be silly or might be
spontaneous.
Spontaneous, mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, a lot of times when you're really being yourself, you aren't following a rule. You're not following a plan. In fact, that's the big thing about being a spirit, is that whole, you know, cliched phrase about life is what happens when you're making plans or, you know, whatever. I think that's how it goes. I don't know. But it's that space where you have to stay open to that moment. You have to stay open to the spontaneity of change and of all of a sudden going, I'm going to do this. This looks good. And this is saying yes. In a way, I call it saying yes to things instead of always, you know, being fearful or saying no. And you sometimes have to just be silly. I was interviewed for my alumni magazine, and she asked a series of questions that she asks everyone she ever interviews. And the last one was, what do you want to say to the students here? And I gave her an answer that was about, well, just pay attention to the fact that what you think you're here for might not be what you're here for. And be open to the knowledge that's here. And you might want to follow the passion instead of the practical, because that'll carry you through things more further. And you won't have to worry about jobs and money if you're following your passion. And she stopped and she said, I've asked that question of every person I've interviewed, and you're the only person who's ever said that. I said, well, that's because you have to be present. And a lot of people do things with that plan in their head of what they got to do today and where they're going in life. And it's not where they even want to be anymore, which I think is why we have a lot of unhappy people. They're too busy following what their mind's telling them and not what their soul is telling them.
And you also talk about the importance of nature and of experiencing nature.
I think that that's the ultimate internet, nature. You know, we're connected to everything in nature. And you, if you can go out and be quiet and really listen and watch and feel, you're really going to hear yourself, because your voice comes out stronger when you're connected in that quiet place with the natural world. And I think that's important. Maybe we should have that be a mandatory thing where everybody has to go camping or something once a month. But it would be a tremendous healing even just to take a walk for an hour and leave your phone home. And for everyone, it's really where you get a healing, tremendous healing.
I recently read an article where it was questioning, should growing food, having a garden, be a mandatory part of like elementary school curriculum? And I know some schools do have gardens, but it's that same thing of recognizing early on that this is a critical connection for us.
Absolutely. I think it teaches you respect for the earth. It teaches you about where things come from that are sustaining you. My favorite memories are my grandpa's farm when I was a kid, or growing tomatoes when I was a kid, and I still do that. But it's that it gives you a certain different connection and kind of a grounded reality of what the world is about. It doesn't all come in a package. Yeah. But we're lucky where we live here, because there's so much connection to nature and so much available to us here that people do. We're really in a remarkable area.
Yes, I agree.
We're very fortunate.
Here in Northern California.
Yes, I'm glad I'm here.
Yes. Kathy Langlois, the book is Enlighten Up, Practical Wisdom and Spiritual Guidance for an Imperfect World. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kathy Langlois, and her book is Enlighten Up, Practical Wisdom and Spiritual Guidance for an Imperfect World. You can visit her at spirithorsecenter.com. Earlier in the show, we heard from Thais Nye Derich with her book, Second Chance, A Mother's Quest for a Natural Birth After Cesarean. I'm Suzanne Lang. We have had production assistance from Anthony Garcia, Sean Knight, and Mark Prell. Stream our show at krcb.org. Subscribe to our podcast and listen anytime. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.